Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. Today is Garden Guy. It's the November Garden Guy with Gary Heilig. Welcome, Gary.
I'm happy to be here.
And my sister Sue Majeure from Kalamazoo.
Oh, it's just a delight to enjoy your company.
Well, good. Hey, Sue, will you lead us in a word of prayer?
I will. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for all of the growing things that you have created and how you use it to teach us about you. Because you invented science, so science and nature can't be divorced. They go together, and they help us learn about your character and how much you truly love us. So give us this opportunity to learn even more about you so we'll understand and love you even more and enjoy your blessings and be grateful. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Gary, I understand that we usually have a topical quiz, but today you've gone eclectic. So do you need to define the word eclectic to us?
Well, it's not on any particular subject. It's whatever came to mind.
Okay.
So the first one is, what fruit should you avoid eating around a beehive?
What fruit should you avoid around a beehive?
Could it be raspberries?
Is that your final answer?
Well, I was thinking about when I picked raspberries, how at the very end of the season, the bees and the wasps are always out there competing.
Do you want to phone a friend? Phone Tom? The answer is a banana.
Banana. Why a banana?
And the reason is bananas are very similar. The smell of the banana is very similar to what's called an alarm pheromone, which will work up the bees and make them more aggressive.
So if you're trying to harvest them, you don't want to be eating a banana?
If I was a beekeeper and I said, I don't really need my protection today, I wouldn't go out there with a banana in my hand.
Does that work the same for wasps, too?
No, it's strictly bees.
Interesting.
So the next one is a biblical question. This one is going to be a little hard. It is, Deborah was the fourth judge of Israel. Where did she hold court?
Oh, it was under a tree, I think.
Yes, but what kind of tree? I mean, you get points just for knowing that.
I thought it was a tree, and I'm trying to think of what tree it was. Was it a sycamore tree or a tamarisk tree or a cedar tree?
You have a guess, Tom?
I fear to guess this time.
Palm tree.
Palm tree, okay.
And you'd find that in Judges 4:5.
Very good.
Here's another biblical one. Heber the Kenite pitched his tent near what type of tree at Zanem, and this is found in Judges 4:11. What type of tree did he pitch his tent near? Now, I will give you a hint on this one. The tree, one of the names of it, is a material that's used for cleaning paintbrushes.
Turpentine.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say turpentine.
Turpentine. It's called the terebinth tree.
Oh, terebinth.
T-E-R-E-B-I-N-T-H, which is also the turpentine tree.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either until I started doing the research. Maybe I'll put all these together and make a game or something. Okay, the next one deals with Noah.
Okay.
After Noah left the ark, he became a farmer. What crops are mentioned that he grew or crop in Genesis 9:10? What did he plant?
A vineyard.
What did he plant? Oh, good.
A vineyard.
Yes, a vineyard. And you know, if you think about that story, what did he do with the grapes?
He consumed them.
He made wine and he got drunk.
Yeah,
and he got in trouble.
So he started out on the wrong foot on that one. Okay, this one's also a Bible question. In 1 Samuel 14, Jonathan, King Saul's son, went off to fight the Philistines without telling his father. Verse 2 tells us that Saul was sitting on the outskirts of Gileath, under what type of tree? And it is a fruit tree, as a hint.
Well, let's see. Could it be a date palm or a fig? A fig tree.
I would guess fig also.
Pomegranate.
Oh, although it's, got us there.
Although the ones that I've seen, they look more like a bush than they do a tree. But in the Bible, it said tree. Okay, this one is about Thanksgiving. November is the month of Thanksgiving. According to the History Channel, what vegetables were likely to have been eaten at this feast? Of course, there's no definitive record. Nobody wrote it down. But based on the types of things that they grew, what are some of the vegetables that they likely had?
I bet because of the three sisters, they would have had succotash.
So you're saying corn and
corn, beans, and squash.
Okay, this is what they had. Beans was on the menu. Also, onions, lettuce, spinach, cabbage, carrots, maybe some peas, and of course, corn. And I found it interesting because they said that the way they would eat corn is they would make it into a cornmeal, and then they would boil it and add molasses. So it's not the kind of fare that I would want on Thanksgiving, but hey, you get what you get.
It was native fruit.
Their version of turkey stuffing?
No, there was no stuffing. It was the turkey, but there was some information that there were deer and various other things, but they didn't mention that turkey was actually on the table for that first Thanksgiving. I think it was 1621. Okay, we're going back to the Bible. Book of Revelation. What is the first crop to be mentioned in the book of Revelation? It's found in Revelation 6:6.
Could it be grapes because of a cup of wine of wrath?
No, I'm going to give you a hint. It's a grain.
Oh.
And they were talking about the price of two things. Barley was one of them. What was the other one?
I would assume it was wheat or corn.
That's right, wheat.
Yeah.
Wheat. All right, another one in Revelation. In Revelation 7:9, God's people were standing before his throne, dressed in white robes and holding branches from what tree?
Olive branches.
What do you think, Tom?
I would say palm branches.
Tom is right this time, Sue.
Oh, he got it. He got it.
Okay, leaving the book of Revelation, what is the rarest color of flowers?
The rarest color of flowers.
A hint is it's a primary color.
Is it blue because they're not as many blue flowers, you know?
That's exactly
like, blue gentians.
That's right, blue. And if you look in nature, you rarely see a blue flower, especially true blue flowers. You might see lavender or very, very light blue or something, but a nice, bold blue like you see a bold red zinnia, you just don't see it in nature very often. And if you
That's
do,
true.
A lot of them are quite small.
Have you ever seen a blue-eyed Mary?
No, I have not.
I saw them. They have a patch of them at the Kalamazoo Nature Center. Mm-hmm. So if you go walk there during the spring wildflower season, they're really beautiful. They have like five petals. You can only see four, and they look kind of like a violet type thing. Mm-hmm. But there are two of the petals are a creamy white, and the other two are an intense purpley blue. And so that's why they're called blue-eyed Marys. And they're rare. They you know, people picked them all and wrecked where they grew. So they're very rare now.
Interesting. Where's this place again?
It's at the Kalamazoo Nature Center. It's on the Beechwood Maple Trail.
I'm gonna have to go over there. I've never been to the Kalamazoo Nature Center.
That's a wonderful experience.
You'll like it there. And they have the sun rain room, too, if it's raining outside. And they have, they have the farmstead, and they have just all kinds of wonderful stuff there.
Okay, so I'll check that out. Now, the next question is, what do white tea, yellow tea, green tea, oolong tea, dark tea, and black tea all have in common?
They have caffeine in it.
Aren't they all camellias? I can't pronounce that. Sinensis, whatever.
Yeah, camellia sinensis. They're all from the same plant. The difference between the teas are purely related to how they're processed.
Really?
When they're picked and how they're processed.
Okay, now this one's really off the wall. You ready for this one?
Alrighty.
How can trees help you to find gold?
How can trees help you to find gold?
Do trees, their roots seek out gold, and so they grow more around gold deposits?
They actually can pick up gold. And there was a study on Australian trees and the concentration of gold particles in the leaves growing 200 meters from the gold deposit was about 2 parts per billion. Whereas the concentration of gold in leaves of trees growing directly over a deposit were as high as 80 parts per billion. So the closer you get to the source of the gold, and we're talking about lode gold here, because there are different types of gold. Like placer gold is what you would find in a river or a stream or an old riverbed. Those are deposits that have come from the lode, which would be in the ground in a mountain or something like that. So as you get closer to the lode gold, then the concentration of the gold ions in the leaves goes up. And you can essentially go to an area where you think there's gold is, and you would look at the different rocks that are there because gold is associated with rock formations. And so you would sample all the different plants and find out what their concentration of gold particles are in the leaves, and it can narrow down where you should start looking.
Does this have something to do with on the relationship of the minerals and the mycorrhizal mat that the trees depend on?
Well, it's just that every element will give off ions. And ions are nothing more than a couple of atoms together. And ions are dissolvable because gold is dissolvable. Normally it's dissolved in nitric acid, but water can dissolve just about anything over time. And so you get very small particles in the soil that the leaves can get, can collect from being picked up by the roots.
Interesting.
And there's probably very, very, very fine particles in the soil anyway, because of if it's, say, a deposit of gold that was moved around by, say, glaciers, it gets ground up pretty fine. We were just on Lake Superior a couple of weeks ago, and we see these black deposits of sand.
Magnetite.
Magnetite's in it, but you'll see these lines of black sand along the shore, and I was just up there testing, and we found gold in that black sand, but it was extremely fine.
So, isn't that interesting? It's true. Our dad, who was a chemist, I remember him telling me that water is the universal solvent.
Given enough time, it could dissolve just about anything. Anyway, so what did you think of those questions?
Oh, they were very interesting indeed.
It was definitely eclectic.
Yeah, I might go back to something next time. It'll deal with something in specific. But what happened was the first couple of questions I just happened to stumble across when I was doing research for something else. And then I said, oh, let's just do different things. And I still wanted to have some Bible questions in there. So
we'll just have to pay more attention to the flora and the fauna whenever we're reading the scriptures.
But I think Sue's disappointed because if you know what it's going to be on, you can kind of prepare. So.
Well, I can always think like that book I read on vanilla. You know, you can always hope that you saw something. But this eclectic one was very interesting. I couldn't remember all of the trees in the Bible, but there's a lot more in there than you think, like that one I found about those gourds that everybody ate and got sick.
Mm-hmm.
And then Samuel, you know, put something in the pot and cured them.
Yeah, I'm going to try to do some more of those because what I did yesterday when I was getting ready for this is I will take out the concordance, Strong's Concordance, and then just start looking up words. I think of plants and say, oh, let's see how many times pomegranate is in there or how many times palm is in there or whatever plant I may have talked about in the past.
Well,
that is very interesting. I enjoyed that quiz.
Well, why don't we take a break and then we'll get into see what Gary's been doing on YouTube lately. So we'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Strong Tower Radio's Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Tom and Sue Majeure and Gary Heilick as the Garden Guy.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back, Tom and Sue Majeure with Gary Heilick. We're doing the garden show, Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilick. We had our quiz in the first segment. This segment, we're going to talk about YouTube channel and winter protection of various plants. But before we do that, we have a question literally from a biologist. We're going to be interviewing her in the spring about pollinators. We think about having milkweed, particularly in the fall, for the monarch butterflies. But what do we plant for host plants for butterflies in the spring, Gary?
Well, there are quite a few species of butterflies in Michigan, and there is a booklet that you can get from Michigan State, and I have one at home. It's about all the butterflies in Michigan, and one of the nice things about that booklet is it shows you a map of their habitat, in other words, where they naturally occur. They also tell you what their host plants are.
Okay.
And then also they'll tell you when you're likely to see them flying.
Okay.
So it's a really good reference, and that's what I use when I'm looking for something on Michigan butterflies. And it's actually Michigan butterflies and skippers. Now, as far as what you would do, if you're trying to attract a certain type of butterfly, the first thing you want to find out is there more than one host plant that they feed on? And if you don't have that host plant in your area, or there's not very much of it, then most of these things you can buy the seeds of. And usually if you go online to companies that sell wildflower seeds, because even though we consider a lot of these things weeds if they're growing in our garden. They're actually wildflowers because they produce flowers and nectar for various insects. And then you need to find out what are the growing conditions for them. There might be some that you have to put through a stratification period first, which means cold temperatures. They may have done that at the seed company already, so you need to know that. And considering when the butterfly needs to start feeding on it, then you count back as to how long it's going to take you to grow that. Usually it'll take anywhere from 2 weeks up to a month for some seeds to germinate. And for them to get any size, it's going to take a couple of months. So if I was trying to start something, I'm probably going to start something in January so that by the time I'm going to put it out in late April, early May, it has enough size to it so that it's going to attract the adults who lay their eggs on the plant so that the larva can feed on them.
Well, Gary, have you been making any new YouTube videos?
Yeah, I have a couple, but the first thing is this last week I reached another milestone, 20,000 subscribers.
Congratulations.
So, that's a long way from 100,000, but I'm still heading there. And the last two videos I made were both on tomato problems because this year was a big year for yellow shoulders.
Yes.
And so I made that video. I think I took some video of that in your tomato greenhouse.
Yeah, yeah.
And some other places, so that's posted. And also I did one on, we talked about this, about the cracking, the growth cracks.
That actually, I dialed back on the water and it seemed to disappear.
Yeah, so I went through in that video all the different factors that are involved in that. But one of the things I'm working on right now is the origin of strawberries, which is a brief history of how we got the strawberry that we have today.
From the wild native.
Yeah, and the reason I'm doing that is because right now I have, I think it's maybe 12 videos on strawberries. And so I've made a list of about 15 additional videos. And so what I'm trying to do is put together sort of like a little class where you can go from A to Z, everything about strawberries, like what are the sweetest varieties and what are the factors that make them sweet, how to plant them, how to fertilize, weed control, insects. And some of the topics that I'm going to do, I'm going to do the top five strawberry insects and diseases. I'll talk about strawberry nutrition, what do they have to offer. If you want heirloom varieties, what are some suggestions, or some of the sweetest strawberry cultivars that you can grow. And so I'm going to do a whole series of them. So if somebody wants to grow strawberries, there'll be a whole playlist just on that. And
are pine berries in there?
Yeah, I do have a video I'm going to make of strawberries versus pine berries. What's the difference? So it'll have just about everything you need to know in order to grow good quality strawberries. And I'll eventually do that with just about all the fruits. And I have about 30 videos on home orchards right now. And I'll be doing another couple of segments, but these are going to be longer. Like the first one on managing your own home orchard was something like a half hour long. And so those will be a little bit longer. And then there'll be shorter videos on certain topics. So that's what I'm working on YouTube right now. And it's a lot of work, but it's fun.
Well, you mentioned about a milestone. Last night when we were recording this, the night before, there was a milestone as the first killing frost.
Not in our area. We've had a frost, but it didn't kill anything.
This is later. I saw something on a weather map. It was a wide generalization on the Weather Channel, but it showed that in our area, which is Cadillac, Michigan.
Yeah, I could expect you guys would have had it.
Yeah, the average, the 30-year average is between September 15th and the September 30th, and we're going to tip our hands that we're recording this on October 12th. So on October 11th, we had a killing frost. I noticed this year more than normal that that frost just killed the pumpkin vines and the plants. I guess I didn't realize that a frost did that.
Well, the warm season crops are going to be the first ones to go. Things like your tomatoes and your peppers and cucumbers and zucchini and all the squashes and pumpkins. They just can't handle cold weather at all. Now, something like your cold crops like cabbages and broccoli and kohlrabi and cauliflower, spinach, all those different things, they can handle some cooler weather. They can take a light frost because, like I said before, a frost is just where ice forms on the surface, but it's not cold enough to freeze the liquid inside the cells. But when you get that hard killing freeze, that's where the cytoplasm inside the cell actually freezes, and we know what happens when a liquid freezes, it expands.
Right.
And so cell walls in plants are rigid, which means they're not flexible in terms of they can't expand and contract. And what happens is the cytoplasm just bursts out of the cell, and all these cells dying means that the plant's going to die.
You know, I just thought about this as we were talking. Another thing, you know, an inexpensive way to put up a fence is to put up those T-posts and string, you know, a fence in between it. But that, especially if you're using, which I've used, is the deer fence, which is about 8 feet tall. Mm-hmm. It likes to bend over, and holding it on that post, you wire it to it, and a little bit of UV rays over 2 years or such, the fence starts
getting more brittle
and stuff.
Now, there are some of these materials that are treated so that they will last a little bit longer. But if you really want a fence to last a while, it's better to get metal.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be around for a long time. Costs you more up front, though.
Oh, vastly. And try to get the width of 7 feet high. That's
you
pricey.
Can. It's going to be $100 a roll easily.
Yeah, and I need several rolls. But the point I was going to
make. Oh, you had the money, Tom.
Oh, sure. So what I did is I tried something unique. I'd never seen it done before, but I took, you know, the loops that you have on the chain link fence that go on top mm-hmm. for the top rail, put that on top of the post. It fits over that. I was shopping, mm-hmm. I went and got one of those post caps and put it on top of a T-post and said, yeah, it'll there, but it's not, nothing holds it on. Gravity is all it does.
Mm-hmm.
But I took a cable, a wire rope cable, and strung it through the top between the rings, and then the fence, the plastic fence, and then I zip tied it to it, and that's holding it down. I'm quite proud of my homemade invention of how to keep that fence. Before, you were basically tying it at the post, and then every 6 or 7 feet, there's no support with the cable, lapping it over, mm-hmm. rolling it over, and then zip tying it in about 5 places. I'm kind of excited to see how long this will last.
Well, if it works for you, that's great. I'll have to get some video of that.
Okay.
It might show up on YouTube one day.
You never know, from Tom's garden to Gary's video.
Well, you have a number of things on my YouTube channel. So, also, November is when we need to put the strawberries to bed. Once we have a good freeze and the leaves just fall flat to the ground, then you should put about 4 inches of straw on them. And strawberries, as I've said in the past, they have very shallow roots. 90% of the roots are in the top 6 inches of the soil. And especially if you have a heavier textured soil, the soil will tend to heave and contract as the water freezes, and that will break those little roots. And I had done an experiment one year where I didn't cover some strawberries just to see how they would grow the next year, and it slowed them down a lot. So you should put that straw on it, and it will do is it will cut down on some of that heaving of the soil. It doesn't really warm the soil because the straw will actually reflect the light off of the ground, but what it does do is tend to keep it from heaving as much. So that's something you definitely want to do. And As far as other things that you can do in the garden, hopefully by November, everything's out. In a lot of places in our state, maybe not so much in Indiana, it's cold enough to where most things have been destroyed. And what I would suggest you do is try to get those things out, especially try to get the weeds out. If you let weeds go to seed, they're going to have seeds for a long time after that. So get all that stuff out of the garden, till it under. November's a little late to put down a cover crop, but at least you can mix up the soil because insects like squash, vine borer, they like to be at a certain level in the soil. So if you stir up the soil with a tiller and they're too deep or too shallow, that decreases their ability to survive through the winter. Now, I expect things are going to be okay this year in terms of survival because we have a very strong El Nino, which means we're going to have a milder winter. So don't count on winter killing anything off.
So need to be more proactive.
Yeah. It's just that there'll be years where we'll have warmer winters and things will survive quite well. I mean, insects can, if they're really well adapted to this area, they could even take our coldest winters if they're in their proper overwintering sites. If they get caught out someplace, then they may not make it. But the majority of them are smart enough to know where they need to go to stay out of the cold. But they certainly won't be under very much pressure in a year like this if it's as warm as they say it's going to be.
That mean that all those dreadful stink bugs that come creeping into the house and in your windows and everything all over the winter are going to be more this year?
Well, they're attracted into the house because of the differential in heat between the outside temperature and the inside temperature. And that includes like the female wasps will come in, the yellow jackets, the leaf-footed pine seed bug comes in, the Asian lady beetle, the brown mammated stink bug. Those are all guys that like to get into your house, and they overwinter in the walls. The wasp will come in, and they won't survive inside the house. But most of the other things, they'll gather in some corner, and they'll spend the winter there if they can. One year, I went into my bedroom, and there were about 50 of those little ladybugs in there, and they just all grouped together in the corner between the walls coming together and the ceiling, and it's just this little mass of ladybugs. So I vacuumed them out. Now, I don't allow any wasp. I have a zero tolerance of wasp in the house now. I don't know if I mentioned this to you or not, Tom, but I was sleeping, and I turned over, and then I felt what I thought was a sting. And it was a wasp that had gotten under the covers and stung me on the arm, and it burned for like 2 days. I was not happy, so I don't allow wasp in the house anymore. Just because of that. And I was pretty easy to get along with. If I saw a wasp, I wouldn't necessarily kill him. I'd let him outside or whatever, but not anymore. Zero tolerance. Now, the Asian lady beetles, they get a little stinky when you mess with them, and so does the mammated stink bug. And even if you vacuum them up, which I like to do, when they go through the vacuum, you can smell them in there. They smell a little bit like cilantro. And they're very similar to cilantro. And I don't know if I said this on radio before, but I actually was eating a sandwich and I bit into it and I heard this crunch. And then this aroma of cilantro was in my mouth. And I said, I didn't put any cilantro on this sandwich. And I had bitten into one of those bugs. I was not pleased.
So were they not tasty?
Well, I didn't move it around the tongue to find out. I just kind of like, and went over to the garbage and just let the sandwich roll off my mouth. But it's not a very pleasant feeling when that's not your intention.
What about watching out for deer in your strawberry patch?
Well, if you don't cover up your strawberries, and even when you plant new ones in the spring, and I'm telling you this from experience, because one year I decided I was going to plant a bunch of strawberries, and I think I'd bought like 300 or 400 strawberries. And I was putting up the post for a fence, but I hadn't gotten the fence up yet, and the strawberries were coming up. and the deer ate them all down. They ate it like I had planted a row of lettuce for them. And the strawberries couldn't come back because they had just been planted. It used up a lot of their energy putting out those leaves, and so many of them never made it. And so you have to be careful because the deer will eat strawberry tops. So it's not as much of a problem in the fall as it is in the spring when that new growth is coming up.
Okay, what is it too late to take a soil test?
No, it's actually prime time to take a soil test so you can avoid that spring rush. And it allows you also to get out there and buy the fertilizers, because fertilizer prices keep going up, and you can have everything ready to go in the spring, because as everybody knows, in the spring you're trying to catch up with the things that you didn't do, like the pruning that you didn't do when you could have done it during the winter. If you didn't clean up your garden, you're doing that. That's the time to prepare the garden and tilling and all of that. And so it's nice to have the soil test done. You're not waiting for it before you start the garden. So now's a good time to take those samples and take them into the University Extension office. And the nice thing about that is the volume is quite low compared to the spring. So it's a good time to do it.
What about poinsettias in the house?
Well,
go ahead, Sue.
I was thinking, somebody had told me that you had to fool around with keeping them in the dark in the closet and certain periods, and it's kind of a fussy thing.
Well, it is true that they have to go through a dark period. They have to go through what we call short days and long nights. And when I worked on the in the greenhouses, the teaching greenhouses, before we left, we would put the poinsettias under these curtains. They were shade curtains at night because our greenhouse was right next to a parking lot. And whenever you have that kind of a situation, if the lights are shining at all hours of the night, it'll mess up their ability to start the flowering process. So we would put those curtains on at 5 o'clock in the evening when we went home, and we take them off when we came in at 8. So 5 to 5 would be 12 hours, and then 8 would be about 15 hours. So you need a long period of darkness and a short day in order to initiate that flowering process. And I think you start about mid-October. I'd have to go back and check. I don't think it's either mid-September or mid-October, but I think it's October. I didn't check that before I came here today. But what I would do is, if you have a poinsettia that you capped and you grew it outside and it's looking pretty good, then go down to, say, Home Depot or Lowe's or someplace and buy a box that's large enough to cover the entire plant. And the easy way to do it is wherever you're keeping the poinsettia, close to the window or whatever, at 5 o'clock in the evening, just cover it over. And that way you won't have to worry about it. Now, if you have a room where nobody goes in, it'll start that process on its own as our days get shorter. But it may not be fast enough for you to have the full blooming by Christmas. And what you're wanting to see is you keep doing this until the bracts, or those upper leaves, start to turn a little red. Once they've started turning, then they don't have to be under darkness anymore.
So you heard that here on the Growing Show, how to force your poinsettia plants to be red by Christmas.
And yeah, and what people should do is, if you want the poinsettia to look better, when you keep it during the summer, when it goes outside during June, then you can cut it back and it'll send up new shoots, and those bracts will get much larger, especially if you're fertilizing once a month and giving it plenty of water and putting it in a slightly larger pot. Or another thing you can do is take cuttings. And I have a video on my YouTube channel showing you how to take the cuttings. And once you have the cuttings, then you pot them up either 3 or 5. It should always be odd numbers to a pot. And that way, then you can set those outside and let them grow, and they'll grow as nicely as what you would see in a garden center. And then when you take them in the fall, if you want to start in September, you just have bracts ready for sure by then. And you just cover up those plants and they'll start to produce.
It's, you know, that's really nice, because it seems like when you, people that I watch trying to preserve their poinsettias, they of course lose the colorful bracts, but they just seem to get all leggy and some of the leaves fall off.
Yeah, the leaves will fall off if they're exposed to strange temperatures, the dry out too much, or they're exposed to really cold temperatures, or if they don't get enough sunlight. They really need to have bright sunlight. If you were to go down to Mexico and southern Texas, they grow outside like shrubs. And then, of course, as the days get shorter, then they start to flower. And the bracts, the red part, those aren't flower. Those are modified leaves, the little yellow bulbous structures on the top are the actual flowers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a fun thing to do if you want to try it. But if you're not a person that can give the plant what it needs, when it needs it, and stick to the schedule, then don't bother. Just go buy them.
Let me run one more thing. I see I skipped over it, but it has to do with soil test, not about the fertility. The low levels of fertility.
In other words, why do we fertilize our gardens?
Yes.
And most people don't realize that before we had commercial fertilizers, the productivity of agriculture was much lower. And if you were to take away what we call chemical fertilizers, then we would not be able to feed the world. We just could not do it, and people would starve to death. So all the manure in the world and stuff just would not provide enough nutrients for all the plants that were growing. But if your nutrient levels are too low in the soil, then the nutrition of the plants will be lower, because they won't have the building blocks that they need in order to make the vitamins, and they can't pick up the minerals from the soil if they simply aren't there. Now, in certain areas of the country, that's more of a problem. Like in the southeast, their soils don't have the mineral level that we have up here in the Midwest. So it's more important in certain areas of the country to make sure that you put certain minerals back into the soil. Also, if a plant is not growing vigorously, that makes it more susceptible to not only disease pressure, but also certain insects, because they'll be attracted to things that are weaker. And then, of course, if a plant is not growing vigorously, it's going to have a harder time competing with weeds, which if people don't get to the weeding, then the weeds can overwhelm the plant. And, of course, that's going to affect productivity, and you just won't get anything. In some cases, the plant may just die because it's shaded. So those are some of the reasons why you really need to make sure that the plants are at the fertility level. Now, you don't have to use chemical fertilizers if you don't want to. There are plenty of good organic fertilizers. You will pay a higher price for those, but there are organic fertilizers that will do the job in your home garden, but we just couldn't do that exclusively on the planet. It just wouldn't work. And a perfect example of that is Sri Lanka. The government said no more chemical fertilizers, and their food production just dropped. And from that, then the government started having problems.
Well, folks, let's conclude segment number two, but we'll be right back and have more topics. We're going to talk about calcium.
When you're taking a trip, it's important to stay on the right road and to follow the GPS or roadmap to be sure that you get to your destination. Likewise, on your trip to heaven, it is vital to follow the roadmap, the Bible, God's positioning system. To do that, stay with Strong Tower Radio as we uplift the Bible and proclaim God's character. If you'd like to help with this mission, go to our secure website, www.strongtowerradio.org, and click on the donate button. or call 231-468-2087. We thank you and may God bless you as we proclaim God's character together.
Hello, we're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, and Sue and Tom Majeure. Gary, what is the nutrient of the month?
It is calcium, and if you remember, there are 16 known essential nutrients that plants must have. And so we're talking about calcium, and if you want to know what it does, calcium is a constituent in the cell walls. Remember we said cell walls were rigid?
Mm-hmm.
That's why, because of calcium in them. And it's also involved in various membranes. And it also helps to uphold a physical barrier against certain pathogens getting in. It might be like a brick wall, if you will. And there are other things that it does, but some of these things get a little bit too sciencey for most people. So those are the main things that it does.
So calcium is very important for the health of a plant.
Yeah. Calcium, just imagine what a human would be like without calcium in their bones.
Wow.
It's for our structure also. It's part of our framework that allows us to walk around. And when people have osteoporosis, they're losing calcium out of their bones. And of course, you know, people get bent over and all kinds of other issues. Anyway, now the next thing people might want to know is, what should the levels be when you get a soil test back? And what it's doing is measuring the amount of calcium in the soil. Luckily for us in Michigan, that's not a problem. But on the soil test, it should be between 430 and 540 parts per million. And if you get your information back on pounds per acre, then all you have to do is double the parts per million numbers, and that'll give you the equivalent pounds per acre. And there's some differences in soils. For instance, if you're on a very sandy soil, the calcium levels can be around 400 to 500 parts per million, which is about 800 to 1,000 pounds an acre. But clay soils will usually test above 2,500 parts per million. But in most cases, and of the 34 years that I did soil test recommendations, I never saw a problem with calcium here in Michigan. So in most cases, we're in good shape. If you're having very high soil calcium levels, and that's an indication that you probably have a pretty high content of clay in your soil. Now, what do we do if we need it, which is rare? And there are examples where plants actually need calcium, even though there's calcium in the soil. And the classic example is on tomatoes, which is blossom end rot. And that is actually a calcium deficiency. And remember, plants get their nutrients from the soil in what's called an ion form. And that ion is in solution. In other words, it's in the water portion of the soil. And if the temperatures, or not temperatures, but if the soil moisture levels drop too low, then the plant can't pull enough calcium out of the soil. That's why you tend to see blossom end rot after a drought. And then you get a lot of rain or something like that. You get the gross cracks and you also get the blossom end rot. And so what the plant does is it says, I need calcium for the new growth, but I can't get it out of the soil. So where am I going to get it from? I'll take it out of the fruit. So it takes it from the fruit, and then the bottom of the fruit starts to rot, and that's what we call blossom end rot. Now, there are ways that you can get calcium, and there's some products that will apply calcium in a foliar spray, and they're usually the kind of materials they use are calcium acetate, calcium nitrate, which is a nitrogen source, calcium chloride, which is a salt, basically. And that's the quickest way to get calcium in a plant, is to put it in solution and spray it directly on the leaves. And there are some products out there that you can spray on developing tomatoes that's supposed to help with that problem. But if you just keep the moisture levels even in your soil and mulch your soil, you'll have very little blossom end rot. Also, you can use bone meal if you are an organic grower. And, of course, bone meal comes from animals. It's ground up bones. And it's a good soil additive, too, because it is organic matter that's going into the soil. But it will raise the calcium levels over time in the soil. But bone meal doesn't give you immediate reaction. It takes time, as well as many other organic fertilizers. And it gradually raises the calcium level over a number of growing seasons.
So it's not even one year? It could be over multiple years?
It could be over multiple years, yeah. But organic fertilizers generally are more like that, because it depends on what you're using. Like if you're using rock phosphate, there's some chemical changes that have to happen so that it's in an available form for the leaves to pick it up, or the roots to pick it up. And for instance, you probably heard me talk about triple superphosphate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically that is phosphate rock that has been treated with an acid to put it in a form that makes the phosphorus more available to the plants more quickly. But some people would rather not do that. Now, the plants couldn't care less where it comes from. But organic fertilizers do give you other benefits in terms of you're less likely to burn a plant. The fertilizer is available over a longer period of time. And there's some good things about that too, especially if you have container plants.
So the calcium in my water, I see calcium deposits. Is that the right form of calcium?
I don't know what form of calcium that is, but there could be other things there. I'd have to go and look that up. A lot of times people will see around their flower pots a white ring.
Correct.
And we call those soluble salts. So there may be some calcium in there, but there are other things in there. And when you see those kind of rings, that means you're not flushing your soil and pushing those nutrients down through the soil. A lot of times people will fertilize, and then when they water, they just water just enough to wet the roots, but they're not flushing all those accumulated soluble salts out of the bottom, and then you start to get those rings. Especially on clay pots, you'll see it a lot.
So that's up there on the top of the soil, not in the bottom.
Yeah, it can be on the top of the soil or around the ring of the pot toward the top of the soil.
Hmm, okay.
It's something you need to watch. If you're starting to see that, then you need to change your watering and change your fertilizer regime.
Well, we're coming to one of your favorite subjects, is the American Selection winners for 2024.
Well, I was a little disappointed. We're in October already, and they've only released one so far. What they used to do when I was working is they would wait and release them all at once. But now they release them when they're ready. So I'm expecting more to come, but right now we only have one, and it's a marigold, and it's a yellow marigold, single color. It's called Siam Gold. And this one did not have a general award for the whole country. It will perform best in the northeastern part of the country. Now, it doesn't mean you can't try it in other places, but it will perform best in that area of the country. And the plant will get to be about 18 to 20 inches, and I'm going to do a little short video in the next couple of weeks on it. And it will bloom from late spring all the way to frost. So once it's in the garden, it's going to do really well. It's a solid pattern, no reds or oranges or anything like that in it. But the blooms are pretty good size. They're 3 to 4 inches across. So it's not a real tall plant. 18 to 20 inches isn't huge, but it has some pretty good sized flowers. So that's
a unique smell that some of the pests don't like.
They don't say anything about that. You have to wait and try it. Usually it's the old type of marigolds that have those smells. A lot of the newer hybrids don't have much of a smell at all. But the only way you can tell is to wait till it comes out and check it out in your garden. I grew one that was kind of similar to that one, only it was a little bit more lacy this year, and it was a really nice marigold. Didn't look like your traditional marigold, and I would certainly grow that one again. And I might try this one next year. We'll see.
Well, very good. Well, Gary, I just want to thank you so much for this month's Good Growing with the Garden Guy. Do you have any ideas where you're going in December?
In terms of what we're going to talk about?
Yeah.
No, I have no idea. Okay. I know Christmas will be involved in some way, but there was another thing I want to talk to you about.
Sure.
I did a little experiment this year where I transplanted my pineapple plants, my avocado trees, and my Cavendish banana outside. Now, my Cavendish was about 4 feet tall when I took it out there and just planted them in the ground like you would a tomato. And I wanted to see how they would do. Now, I did get them ready first so that they wouldn't get sunburned. And my Cavendish banana is like 7 feet now. I was hoping it would bloom and produce bananas this year, but you need a full 6 months for it to ripen the fruit. But it didn't produce a flower. Now, it should produce a flower next year because it's like 2 years old now. So it is going to hopefully do it next year. But I won't have to buy any more because it has sent up some side shoots. So I have like four little banana plants coming off the sides, which it never did in the house. The avocado, my Haas avocado, has done well. The others didn't do that well because they weren't in very good shape when they went outside. But the Haas really got much thicker, which I was hoping it would branch more. And so I'm very happy about that one. And then the pineapples grew very well, nice and dark green. So I'll put those back outside in the garden probably late May of next year and grow them like I would any other garden plant. So I was very happy about that. And the last thing I wanted to tell you, if you're a coffee drinker, don't throw out those coffee grounds, because you can use them as an organic fertilizer by sprinkling on the top of house plants and things in the garden. And remember, they're also good for killing snails. So if it's still warm enough, you can spread them in the garden and the snails eat them and it'll kill them. Or you can just put them in the compost pile, and then that'll add more organic materials to the gardens. So those are the tips for this month.
Very good. Well, thanks again, Gary. Gary, give us the YouTube address so that people can look at this growing collection of videos.
Well, you can go to any search engine and type in Get Growing with Gary, or just type in Gary Heilig, and it'll take you to the YouTube page. And also, don't forget to continue listening here on Strong Tower Radio. And if you have a question that you want answered, give us a call at the station. Tom can give you the number, and I'll be happy to include it in the program.
Yeah, that's 231-468-2087. And I'm Tom Majeur for Sue and Gary. Until next month, good growing. Bye now.